city that day, as people who are humiliated steal away when they flee in battle.
All right, so it's this really odd dynamic now of anybody that's left with Absalom in that revolt and sided with him, and that got put down. What do they do, right? So now do they kind of come back into the city? You're like, oh, yeah, we were here the whole time. Hey, David, you know, like, it's all good. So now they're going to have to figure out, like, how's David going to respond to this? Because they've, much of the city, specifically the north in Israel, has abandoned, and Judah has as well, David, and sided with the son. So now Joab, again, comes on the scene, and here's the great side of Joab. David is kind of, like, in mourning and won't kind of come out of his whole... his funk that he's in, which it's appropriate that he's mourning his son, but he's not leading. And Joab says now in verse 5, today you have covered with shame the faces of all your servants, who today have saved your life and the lives of your son and daughters, the lives of your wives and the lives of your concubines. David, you cover their faces in shame, all these people who saved your life. And in verse 6, this is the key. Keep reading there. What does that mean? You've loved those who have hated you. Who's that speaking to? Absalom. He gave you the middle finger, right? And he said, I'm taking your throne, but you've loved him. And those that have loved you, you've hated. Who's that? It's the people, right? They're trying to come back. They're trying to be loyal to you, but you're spending all your time crying about Absalom being dead, and you won't bring the people back in. So it's this really weird, difficult dynamic, okay? You have shown today that princes and servants are nothing to you. For I know this day, if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead, you would be pleased. That is hard truth, but that's the gospel truth in David's life. If he could trade the nation for his son, he would do it. And Joab realizes that. He's like, man, get over it. Look, I'm sorry he's dead. Not really, because I killed him. However, you need to get back up and lead. So again, this tension between Joab being an absolute loose cannon, and then yet one of David's best and most honest advisors. Say what you will about Joab, but he shoots David straight. And by the end of it all, you won't like him. But nonetheless, he gives David good advice. And he says, now therefore, verse 7, arise, go out and speak kindly to your servants, for I swear by the Lord, if you do not go out, surely not a man will pass the night with you, and this will be worse for you than all the evil that has come upon you from your youth until now. If you don't rally the people, and if you don't show kindness to them, your kingdom's over. And if you think what has been bad, wait until you see the ramifications of your lack of leadership now. So it's great advice, and David takes it. Verse 8. So you're going to see this phrase repeated, to his own home, or Israel had fled each to his own tent, depending on what version you're reading. It's the idea that during Absalom's revolt, the people fled with Absalom or went and sided with them, and now they're having to come back into town. And we're going to see that again under Solomon, again under David, in more times to come towards the end of his season of reign. So there's just disorder, and there's a lack of unity and a lack of allegiance, and David's going to have to be the one that's magnanimous enough to say, come home, I forgive you, and I mean, what's been done is done, but we need to lead here. So all the people now, the problem is, are quarreling in verse 9. And the tribes of Israel were saying, the king delivered us from the hand of our enemies and saved us from the hand of the Philistines, but now he has fled out of the land from Absalom. However, Absalom, who you anointed over us, has died. Now then, why are you silent about bringing the king back? Look, you sided with Absalom, tribes of Israel. That's fine. He saved your life, or David did, and now Absalom's dead, but you're not talking about bringing David back. The people don't know what to do. They're confused and scared as to what the right decision is. David then sent spies, sent Zadok and Abiathar, saying, speak to the elders of Judah, saying, why are you the last to bring back the king to his house, since the word of Israel has come back even to his own house? Why would David send people to Judah and say, why have you not brought the king back? Why have you not celebrated David coming back to the throne? Why Judah? Where's David from? Judah, the first people to bring David back should have been the folks from Judah. So Israel and Judah are having a rough time here. He says, you are my brothers, you are a bone of my flesh. Why then should you be the last to bring back the king? So again, this is from a lack of David's leadership and from the tension that's going on in the kingdom. Okay, now David, in order to bring back some unity in verse 13, watch what he does. Who's Amasa, and what is David doing with this guy? We've seen his name before. When Absalom led his revolt, who is his general? Amasa. What is David now doing? He's saying, you're my new general. Why would David be doing that? It's twofold, huh?
To bring unity?
Yeah, to bring unity. Hey, look, the guy that I would hate the most, you think, is Amasa. Nope, he's now chief of my staff, and I just fired Joab. Why would David fire Joab? Because he's killed his son, right? So, like, there's multiple reasons for this. So, if David can forgive Amasa, who was, you know, the leader of Absalom's revolt, surely he can forgive everybody else. So, this was, in a sense, a wise PR move, if you will, okay? Thus, he turned the hearts of all the men of Judah in 14 as one man, and they sent word to the king saying, return you and all your servants. So this works. And now David's going to see now a couple folks you're going to meet. Chapter 19, verse 16, Shammai. You remember the cursing mooner? He's coming back, so David's going to deal with him. 24, Mephibosheth, who we've seen the story already. And then a guy by the name of Barzillai. Barzillai is that old dude that David was leaving town, and he's like, dude, just let me stay here. I'm old. And the question will be, did David see that as a lack of faithfulness to him, a lack of loyalty, or not? So, but you're going to see a very different attitude in David, who's typically been a warrior. Watch what he does. Shammai, verse 16, comes in, and he hurried and came down and the men of Judah to meet David. There were a thousand men of Benjamin with him. With Ziba and his 15 sons, his 20 servants, they're all there. Verse 18, Shammai, the son of Gera, fell down before the king as he was about to cross the Jordan. What does this guy think's coming? Shammai, the cursing mooner, now that David's back on the throne. Probably death, right? He's probably thinking, David was gracious to me when he didn't have the position of power. Now he clearly has it. What has he done? Okay. And he says in 19, let not my Lord consider me guilty. Do not remember what your servant did wrong that day. It's kind of hard to not forget that, Shammai. You were cursing and mooning me. Like, I got that implanted in my head now. Your servant knows in verse 20, I have sinned. Therefore, I have come this day to confess, basically. And then Abishai says in verse 21, Abishai, one of Joab's brothers, should not Shammai be put to death for this because he cursed the Lord's anointed? So Abishai says, man, let's kill him. Abishai, the guy that stood with the spear over Saul, and says, let me run him through right now, David. And David says, no, relax, dude. You know, we're not going to shish kebab Saul right now. Abishai's a, you know, punch first, ask questions later type guy. And he's got the right to do it. Okay, in 20, watch what David does. 22, rather. Somebody pick up there.
But David said, what have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah? That you should this day be an adversary to me. Shall anyone be put to death in Israel this day? For I do not know that I am this day king over Israel.
So what is he saying? For do I not know that I am king over Israel? Shall anybody be put to death today? I'm king over Israel again. So God's will has been accomplished. I'm not putting anybody to death. So David's gracious in this moment, realizing, man, God's restored the throne to me. I don't need to exact vengeance for vengeance sake, to get a pound of flesh, if you will. David says, I'm not interested in that. So he tells him in verse 23, you shall not die. So he says, I'm not going to touch him. Okay. 24, you see the story with Mephibosheth. We've read that before. And then 31, Barzillai comes to him. And Barzillai says in verse 32, was old, 80 years old. And he had sustained the king, for he was a very great man. The king said, man, cross over with me. I will sustain you in Jerusalem. So David sees his act that not coming with David into desolation as he had to cross over the Jordan and live in the wilderness, not as an act of unfaithfulness, but just a simple, like, man, I can't make this trip. And David says, come back with me into Jerusalem, and I'll take care of you. And Barzillai says now in verse 34, how long have I yet to live? Should I go up with the king to Jerusalem? I'm 80 years old. Can I distinguish between bad and good? Meaning, like, dude, I got to put my dentures in, right? Like, I'm so old, I can't even chew my food. Like, can I eat? Can I drink? Can I taste even what I eat or drink? He's like, dude, I'm about to die. There's no need to honor me. Why should your servant be an added burden to my lord the king? Like, man, you're going to have to change my diapers. Like, just let me be, David. I love you. He said, your servant would merely cross over the Jordan with the king. Like, man, I don't need this reward. And then he says, please let your servant turn that I may die in my own city near the grave of my father and my mother. He says, just let me die here. And David says, man, I'm with you. Okay, so what you're seeing in David overall is a very gracious king who's not after a pound of flesh, is not seeking his own name. To the people that he does not have to be gracious to, he's gracious to. So all three of these guys, okay? Now the problem is you're going to see more of David's trepidation and a bit of his issue. In verses 40 through the end of chapter 19, you're seeing Israel and Judah continue to bicker back and forth about who's really most loyal to David, why there's issues. So there's still this tension in the kingdom that's occurring in 40 through 43. And a guy in chapter 20, verse 1, a worthless fellow by the name of Sheba, who is a Benjamite, sees an opportunity because there's still division in the kingdom. And this is what he says, 20, verse 1. Alex, pick up there.
Now, a worthless fellow happened to be there whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite, and he blew the trumpet and said, we have no portion in David, nor do we have inheritance in the son of Jesse, every man to his tents, O Israel.
All right, what does that mean? Every man to his tents, O Israel. We have no portion in David or in Judah or Jesse. Yeah, we're all on our own, okay? Judah, they may follow David. They have to because they're from Judah. But Israel, the northern 10 tribes, we're out. Follow me is what he's saying. So what is this? What's happening all over again? We got another coup. Now, this guy isn't David's son. He's an opportunist. He is a guy from Benjamin. Why would that be important? That's where Saul was from, right? So there's this connection. So he's going to lead a coup. He wants the kingdom. David is going to handle this differently. So he says, verse 2, all the men of Israel withdrew from following David and followed Sheba. So that quickly, the tides turn. Okay, so they're going to follow now this new guy in town, this new sheriff, Sheba. David now comes in verse 3 to Jerusalem and gives word now to his new commander, verse 4, Amasa, and says, call out the men of Judah for me within 3 days and be present here yourself. Meaning, get the guys ready to fight. In 3 days, we need to be ready to go. We're going to put down this coup, and David's going to get on it. The problem is Amasa is a young man. He doesn't have Joab's experience in battle, and he delays for some reason. So Amasa went to call out the men of Judah in verse 5, but he delayed longer than the set time which had been appointed to him. David gives him 3 days, and he blows it. And Joab, you remember what happens when you take Joab's job. People start dying. You can imagine how long this guy's going to live, right? Not long. Joab hears that this guy blew it, and Joab wants his job back. So he sees an opportunity, and he says, man, we got to get on this. He realizes that, man, if David lets this coup unfold, it's going to be a disaster. So he handles this one very differently than he handles the coup with his son. So Joab's men go out after him, this army that David's trying to rally, and Amasa himself. And Joab corners Amasa. Okay, see if you can see where this thing's going. Verse 9, read that.
Joab said to Amasa, is it well?
Actually, I'm sorry. 8, Alex, start there if you don't mind.
When they were at the large stone, which is called Gibeon, Amasa came to meet him. Now Joab was dressed in his military attire, and over it was a belt with a sword, and in it sheath fastened at his waist, and as it went forward, it fell out. Joab said to Amasa, is it well with you, my brother?
So Joab's got his military gear on, his sword in his sheath, and he leans forward and his sword falls out. Okay, this is strategic. So now, instead of his sword being sheathed, he picks it up off the ground, right? And he goes in to grab Amasa and kiss him. Can you see the scene here, right? Typical Joab. Keep going.
But Amasa was not on guard against the sword which was in Joab's hand, so he struck him in the belly with it and poured out his inward parts on the ground and did not strike him again, and he died. Then Joab and Abishai, his brother pursued Sheba, the son of Beer.
Just like that, dude. He just literally, sorry, he literally guts Amasa in the middle of the road. Joab is, dude, you talk about a non-harmonizer. This guy does not have a feeling other than like bloodlust and vengeance. That's all he can think of. So he strikes him and he dies. Like Amasa's just like, has no idea what's coming. So just like Abner, Joab just guts a guy. It's bad. Now, it gets, you see how hard-hearted Joab is. I laugh because it's just, there's nothing else to do. Joab stood by him in verse 11 and said, "Whoever favors Joab and whoever is for David, let him follow Joab. I'm the new guy in town." Amasa, verse 12, lay wallowing in his blood in the middle of the highway. He's not dead yet. He's just gutted him. Okay, so if you've seen Braveheart, this is not a good way to die. Okay, so he's trying to rally the troops, and Amasa's laying there dying a slow, painful, awful death. When the men saw that the people stood still, he removed Amasa from the highway into the field and threw a garment over him. When they saw that everyone who came by him stood still, like nobody could, like it's like giving people their test in the middle of a class period and then asking the teacher asks for you to focus on them. Like it's not happening. All they can see is Amasa dying. Like, Joab, what are you doing? And they're paralyzed in fear. So Joab's like, throw him off the side of the road, throw a blanket over him. Don't finish him off. Like, let him wallow there in pain for taking my job. And now that he's off the highway, the people can come and follow Joab. He's brutal, dude. Just brutal. So, yeah, there you go. Don't name your kid Joab, right? He gives good counsel, but short of that, man, he's a loose cannon. So, anyway, Joab is going to get the kingdom back for David. So he's going to chase now after Shimei, this Benjamin who's risen up and brought this coup. Verse 15, they chase this guy, verse 14, into a town called Abel. Abel is a city way north in Israel, so they fled now from Jerusalem north, and it is about 4 miles west of Dan. So the farthest northern city in Israel, 4 miles west of that is where they flee to, and this is a funny story, okay? They come now, and Shimei has basically walled himself into this city, and they have put up in verse 15 a siege ramp against the city and start destroying the city. They're going to destroy the whole city for the sake of one dude. All the people in verse 15 were with Joab, were wreaking destruction in order to topple the wall. So they're going to knock the wall down in order to get this guy out. And watch happens in verse 16. Emily, read that.
Then a wise woman called from the city, "Listen, listen, tell Joab, come here that I may speak to you." And he came near her, and the woman said, "Are you Joab?" He answered, "I am." Then she said to him, "Listen to the words of your servant." And he answered, "I am listening." Then she said, "They used to say in former times, 'Let them but ask counsel at Abel,' and so they settled in matter."
So she's saying, hey, listen, they used to come to the city to get disputes answered. This is a very, very wise city. So, Joab, listen to what I have to say.
"I am one of those who are peaceful and faithful in Israel. You seek to destroy a city that is a mother of Israel. Why will you swallow up the heritage of the Lord?"
Meaning, hey, look, I'm Switzerland here. Like, I don't have a bone to pick in this fight. Like, are you going to destroy this whole city for the sake of this dude? Like, we're not anti you, Joab. Like, calm down. Keep rolling.
"Joab answered, 'Far be it from me, far be it that I should swallow up or destroy. That is not true. But a man of the hill country of Ephraim, called Sheba the son of Bichri, has lifted up his hand against King David. Give up him alone, and I will withdraw from the city."
All right, so what does Joab say? "I just want this dude. So you give him up and we'll leave." And she says, this is awesome,
"Behold, his head shall be thrown to you over the wall."
I'm not even going to give him all up. I'll just toss his head over the wall and you'll have evidence that he's dead. And sure enough, dude, she walks back into the town. All the people come together and they cut off the head of Sheba, verse 22, the son of Bichri, and threw it to Joab. Literally, over the wall. Like, you don't see it coming. There's a wall in between you and Joab. And she's like, "Are you ready? Here it comes." And they huck his head over the wall. So, 22 or 21 rather, Yeah, anyway, she convinces the people in 22, the beginning of 22, they cut off his head, throw it over, and Joab's like, great, we're good here. So he blew the trumpet, they were dispersed from the city, each to his own tent. Joab returned to Jerusalem, to the king, and says, coup's over, got his head. So there you go. So wise woman saves the day. So fascinating, right? It's interesting, just as a side note, you see how many women God uses throughout David's life to rescue him from his own anger or stupidity or overreaction. It starts with Nabal's wife, Abigail, who says, David, do calm down. You don't need to kill Nabal and with all your men and all his men for the sake of food. Like, let me bring you food, and he relaxes. You see it here again. You see a wise woman from Tekoa, a few chapters ago that convinces David, hey, man, you're forgiven. Your son's forgiven with this great story. So it's fascinating how God interweaves these wise women into the story, that without them, we would have seen a lot more destruction, a lot more chaos in the process. So
something that women say that calms men down.
Seriously, yeah. Here's some food, eat. Okay, you happy now? Okay, now let's talk. So I tell you that story, my old senior pastor in Sherman, church that I got canned from. We would have meetings, and I always knew meetings were going to be really, really bad when he said, Mike, have you eaten yet? And I'm like, oh, no. Because he knows he's about to hit me with a shotgun, and if I'm not, like, fully fueled, like, my blood sugar's going to plummet, and I'm going to be cranky. So I always knew that was bad. Like, hey, let's go have lunch first. I'm like, oh, man. Like, dang it. At least I'll enjoy the lunch. So, yeah, that was always the cue.
Was he about to lay you out, or just because the meeting was
long? Usually meant it was going to be long, and he had things that were going to be difficult to say that I needed to hear, so, or didn't want to hear, whatever it was. But he always gauged my temperament based on how full I was. So anyway, so Joab, verse 23, was over the whole army of Israel, got his job back. There's a guy by the name of Benaiah, who you're going to meet in a couple chapters, who's one of my favorite dudes in the Bible. Son of Jehoiada was over the Cherethites and the Paleothites. So Benaiah is one of David's like sub-captains of his army. So just remember this guy's name. We'll see him again in chapter 23. He's bad. Now, in 24 and following, you get a couple little ditties on just things that are mentioned that speak to the entire reign of David. 24, specifically, this is interesting. Alex, read that.
And Adoram was over the forced labor.
Okay, pause right there. Adoram or Adoram, whatever this guy's name is, was over the forced labor. What's forced labor?
Slavery.
Where is this? In Israel. So David has put his own people, it seems, now, Text and Chronicles says that it was outsiders, but it seems that some of his people potentially may have been put into forced labor underneath David. Do we have a problem with that? We're not supposed to do that in Israel, right? So as you look at, again, the grand narrative of David, you see a lot of things that are mentioned that the Bible isn't condoning, but yet we see like symptoms of sin in David, right? Multiple wives, we see an anger issue, we see forced labor, we see murder, we see adultery. So though he is a man after God's own heart, he certainly has faults, and it's debatable. Now, Solomon, when he comes in, by the way, this same guy that's over the forced labor, Solomon's like, you've done a great job, you're going to be my boy, and he's going to increase the forced labor in Israel a ton, because he needs to build a really fancy building called the temple, and the people are going to hate Solomon as a result of the forced labor that he puts the Israelites under, and he learned it from his dad. Okay, so just interesting notes. We don't see a lot more than that, but there's just cues in David's life where you go, man, we shouldn't see that, right? That's not necessarily a good thing, okay? So, coup's been put down, so David survived yet another one, but it's been touch and go, okay? Now, this is fascinating. 21:1, let's pick up here. Let's watch now what's happening in the land. So this is odd. We don't see this in the text anywhere, but God brings a famine, and apparently the reason he brings a famine is because Saul slayed the Gibeonites. Who are the Gibeonites? is remember the people that came from afar during Joshua's day, Joshua 9. Hey, we're from a really far off place here. We're not wineskins, right? Those guys. And Joshua makes a covenant with them and says, I can't kill you. And then he finds out like 2 days later, oh, you're actually my next door neighbors. I shouldn't have made a covenant with you. Oops. But he puts them in service of the tabernacle at the time. And Israel's not allowed to touch him. What does Saul do? He kills him. Why? He doesn't like him for whatever reason. And now God is bringing a famine during David's day as a result of this. So it's not David's fault, but he's experiencing the consequences of it. Okay, so David is like, man, I don't know what to do. He calls the Gibeonites over and says, hey, listen, this is as a result of Saul. Verse 2. Verse 3, rather. What should I do for you, and how can I make atonement that you may bless the inheritance of the Lord? Look, we did you wrong. I didn't. Saul did. But I'll make this right. What do I need to do for you? In verse 4, this is the response now to David.
Then the Gibeonites said to him, we have no concern of silver or gold with Saul or his house, nor is it for us to put any man to death in Israel. He said, I'll do whatever you say.
What is he saying? Look, we don't want money, we don't want Saul's cash, and we don't want to put a bunch of people to death. We don't want to have a war over this. So here's what we want. Verse 5.
Us and plan to exterminate us from remaining within any border of Israel. Let 7 men from his sons be given to us, and we will hang them before the Lord in Gibeah of Saul, the chosen of the Lord. And the king said, I will give them.
Ooh, so what is the request? I need 7 of Saul's sons. We're going to put them to death. So we don't want your money, we don't want a war, but we need 7 descendants, sons of Saul. As a result. Now, who's the descendant of Saul that comes to your mind right now? Mephibosheth. And David made a promise to him saying, I'll spare your life. So, is Mephibosheth and this promise that he's made worth more than stability in his kingdom? But the king in verse 7 spared Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, because of the oath of the Lord, which was between them, between David and Saul's son Jonathan. He took down, verse 8, other sons, and a guy named Mephibosheth is mentioned here, so there's 2 in Saul's line. He gave 5 of the sons of Merab, the daughter of Saul, whom had born to Adriel, the son of Barzillai, to the Metholite, gives them 5 of her kids. Verse 9, we get a total of 7 kids that are given to the Gibeonites. End of verse 9, they were put to death in the first of the harvest at the beginning of the barley harvest. So they are literally executed publicly. Okay, 7 sons of Saul, 7 sons and grandsons. And Rizpah, one of the concubines of David and concubines of Saul, took sackcloth and spared it for herself on the rock from the beginning of the harvest and raised them from the sky. She allowed neither birds of the air nor the sky to rest on them that day, nor the beast of the field by night, meaning she goes and protects the bodies of these slain sons out of honor. David finds out about this in verse 11, honors them, and also at this point finds out about these folks and gets the bones now of Saul and Jonathan in verse 12 from the men of Jabesh-Gilead who rescued Saul and Jonathan from the wall. Remember that story? Gets their bones, brings them back now into Israel, buries them in verse 14. In the country of Benjamin, where they should have been properly buried. And it says at the end of verse 14, this is pretty cool, that God was moved by prayer for the land. So this sense of national repentance, God is executing justice, even though it was in Saul's day against David. He brings the hammer, and yet he's moved by prayer for the righteous decisions that David's making and spares the life of Mephibosheth. Okay, so pretty cool. Verse 15, we're seeing now at the end of David's life. He's an older man. By the time we get to chapter 1 of 1 Kings, David's going to be about 70. We are at the very, very tail end of his reign. David, verse 15, goes out to battle again. And whether or not this is a summary of battles that he's fought or kind of a chronological battle, not sure, but he goes out to fight against the Philistines in verse 15. At the end of verse 15, it says, David became weary. He's losing a battle and has to have his life saved. Verse 16, read that.
Then Ishbi-Benob, who was among the descendants of the giant, the weight of whose spear was 300
girded with a new sword, and he intended to kill David.
And he was gonna, okay? So keep rolling.
But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, helped him, and struck the Philistine and killed him. Then the men of David swore to him, saying, "You shall not go out again with us to battle, so that you do not extinguish the lamp of Israel."
So this 60, 65-year-old king is fighting against 20-something-year-old giants from the Philistine, and Abishai has to come in and literally save David's life, okay? And they say, "You're done, okay? Love you, mean it. Go back home, sit on your couch, eat some bonbons, okay? Stay off your roof, and you can stay home for battle, okay?" Should I like that? 18 now. We're seeing more war with the Philistines. It's a tense time. Aaron, you're my favorite, man. I would love to watch movies with you, like my kids. Stop talking. My middle child wants to talk all the way through movies. It literally drives me nuts. Like, anyway, story for a different day. You guys will get along really well. Came about after this in verse 18. They went to war again with the Philistines at Gob. Mine says Gob in verse 18, probably Gezer. First Chronicles tells us it's a city, strategic place. Again, they're battling. Now, we see a story that sounds a bit familiar. It says, then Shebekai, the Husheterite, struck down Saph, who was among the descendants of the giant. There was war in verse 19 with the Philistines at Gob or Gezer. You see all these guys mentioned, and one of these guys is named Goliath. The Gittite, okay, from Gath, the shaft of whose spear was like a weaver's beam. Does that sound familiar? That's 1 Samuel 17, right? So, like, wait a second. Is this, what's going on here? There was war at Gath again. There was a great man of stature, had 6 fingers on each hand, 6 toes on each hand, 24, or on each foot, rather, 24 in number, and he also been born of the giant. So, your 6-fingered man, you guys ever seen,
oh, yeah.
Like the greatest movie ever, The Princess Bride? Gosh, if you haven't seen that, you've got to see it. Anyway, there was a 6-fingered man. We got a 6-fingered man and 6-toed man, 24 total. And he's a descendant of the giants in Gath, okay? Anyway, this story is odd in that somebody else is given credit for killing Goliath in this story, not David. 1 Chronicles tells the story as well. So we're not sure if some have suggested that the 1 Samuel 17 version of the killing of Goliath is a big farce in order to raise up David and make him be the hero king, and really it's this guy who killed him, or there just happens to be 2 guys named Goliath from Gath that were both giants. One got killed by David in 1 Samuel 17, and the other guy gets killed here. Given how many names there are, we got 2 Mephibosheths in the same chapter in the same family. It's pretty easy to go, yeah, there's probably just 2 Goliaths, right? It's not that big of a deal. But textual critics want to make a huge deal of it. They say, see, the Bible's all jacked up, so you can't believe it. Anyway, so I take the fact that there's probably 2 Goliaths because, I don't know, God just had a short list of names, I guess, to draw from. Super creative, but yeah, we get a lot of the same names. So anyway, if that ever comes up in, you know, your Bible debating classes, feel free to tell them that they're stupid. And there's a quite easy explanation. So anyway, so giants in the land, we're seeing more of the same, okay? Those are put down, and it's David's men ultimately that are coming to his aid, okay? Chapter 22, by the way, it's called the Song of David. If you've got a chapter heading, it is Psalm 18. It is almost identical to Psalm 18. And it's David's song, basically, it's a hymn of David singing about God's goodness and delivering him and his enemies from Saul and other victories that they've had. So towards the end of David's life, David pens this, but it's basically a memoir of David saying to the Lord, "You have taken great care of us militarily. You've delivered us." So we won't read it all, obviously, all the way through verse 51. Yeah, Psalm 18, okay? But it's David singing of the amazing, gracious activities of God on his behalf, okay? Chapter 23 now, as we move through there, my chapter heading in my Bible says the last words of David. Okay, so we've got a 70-year-old king who's about to die. Chapter 1 of 1 Kings, which is 2 chapters from now, David is going to die. He's going to hand his throne over to his son, and we're going to see him exit life. Okay, but 23, 1 and following, there's kind of a, well, it's a psalm-like thing as well, but I just want you to listen to this. This is really, really cool. Somebody pick up in 23:1, and just I want you to see how David describes himself in his role in the kingdom. Alex, pick up there if you don't mind.
And David spoke the words of the song to the Lord, and the day of the Lord delivered him from the hand of all of his enemies and from the hand of Saul.
Are you in 23:1?
Now these are the last words of David. David, son of Jesse, declares, the man who has raised on declares, as raised on high declares, the anointed of God of Jacob and the sweet psalmist of Israel.
Notice where David links his life to at the beginning. David, the son of Jesse, right? I mean, he's a king, and yet he links his life to, man, I'm the son of a shepherd, right? And how does he describe himself at the end of verse 1? The sweet psalmist of Israel. Isn't that cool? Like, David sees his life as a king as that, and he certainly is, but he also sees it as he's a psalmist at heart, man. He's a worshiper, and that's how he sees his life. The Spirit of the Lord spoke by me, and his word was on my tongue. That's amazing. Can you imagine having that type of... David is writing our quiet times. He's writing psalms that we would read thousands of years later. God's word was literally on his tongue. I mean, that is amazing. Okay, keep rolling, Alex, in 3.
The God of Israel said, the Rock of Israel spoke to me. He who rules over men righteously, who rules in the fear of God, is as the light of the morning when the sun rises, the morning without clouds, when the tender grass springs out of the earth through sunshine after rain. Truly, is not my house so with God?
That's a beautiful picture, right? It's like the morning after a rain, like we're about to experience, right? The sun's coming up, the dew's on the grass. It's this idea of peace and prosperity when what? Look at the end of verse 3. He who rules over men righteously, who rules in the fear of God. David's describing his 40-year tenure as king, saying, I ruled in fear of God. I submitted. And the reason I'm a great leader is because ultimately, though with some significant bumps on the road, I walked with God. And David's saying, that's what made me who I am. So, beautiful picture. Keep rolling at 5, Alex.
Truly is not my house so with God, for he has made an everlasting covenant with me.
Or what is he referencing there? God has made an everlasting covenant with me.
To establish his house.
Yeah, where is that? What text? You're going to want to know that. 2 Samuel chapter 7, okay? You guys need to know those. Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 through 3, the Abrahamic covenant, land, seed, and blessing, and the offshoots of each one of those are important, okay? 2 Samuel 7 is God's promise to David, okay? There's not a whole lot of covenants in Scripture. You want to know the ones that they are, okay?
2 Samuel what?
7. Keep rolling, Alex. Everlasting covenant with me.
Ordered in all things and secure, for all my salvation and all my desire will he not indeed make it grow. But the worthless, every one of them will be thrust away like thorns, because they cannot be taken in hand. But the man who touches them must be armed with iron and a shaft of spear, and they will be completely burned with fire in their place.
All right, so you see David's reliance on the Lord and all that. Okay, now in 8 and following, this is a dude's chapter. Okay, you're going to meet some guys. As we talk about David's mighty men, the guys that have been with him since 1 Samuel chapter 22, when David was hiding in the caves of Adullam, and the worthless and abandoned men from Saul's kingdom rallied to David in his darkest day. These are the dudes that are with him. 37 mentioned in all. Okay, in the last verse of chapter 23, we see Uriah the Hittite is named last. He was one of David's mighty men. And there's a few that are mentioned in here that I'll just read some of their stories. These are great. Okay, verse 8 of chapter 23. These are the names of the mighty men whom David had. Joshab, Bashabeth, a Tachiamite, chief of the captains, was called Adino, the Eznite, because 800 men were slain by him at one time. 800 verse 1, who wins? The one. This guy is bad. After him was Eleazar, the son of Dodo. You think that guy got picked on the playground a little bit growing up? You better be bad. He was one of the three mighty men with David when they defiled the Philistines who were gathered there to battle, and the men of Israel had withdrawn. He arose and struck the Philistine Philistines until his hand was weary and clung to the sword. And the Lord brought about a great victory that day, and the people returned after him only to strip the slain. This guy fought until he literally could not fight anymore, and his hand was weary from slaying Philistines. And the only reason other people came in to help was to pick up all the loot from the battle that he had won on his own. So this guy is amazing, okay? Jordan, keep rolling there in 11.
And after him was Shema, the son of Agi, Heratite. And the Philistines gathered into a troop where there was a plot of ground full of lentils, and the people fled from the Philistines.
So this guy's on a very small stage. He's in a field of lentils. He's in the middle of nowhere, but this is what he does. Verse 12.
He took his stand in the midst of the plot, defended it, and struck the Philistines, and the Lord brought about a great victory.
Right, big stage, small stage, whatever God gives you, that's what he has. And man, he took his stand, and he fights for David. Okay, verse 13, the three of the 30 men, you'll see mentioned often amongst the 30 or the 37, there's three that David has even raised up above and beyond, kind of the leaders. David said to them when they were in the stronghold in verse 14 within the garrison of the Philistines, he said, I have a craving, verse 15, oh, that someone would give me water to drink from the well of Bethlehem, which is by the gate. They're in a stronghold, maybe Masada, maybe in Adullam somewhere. But David's saying, man, you know what would be great right now? I'd like a drink of water from my hometown, in Bethlehem. And these guys say, okay, verse 16. So these guys, three of them, break through the Philistine army, cross through them, get a cup of water, cross through again, bring it back to David and say, here's what you asked for, here's your Aquafina. And this is what David does.
And he said,
nevertheless.
He would not drink it, but he poured it out to the Lord.
I hope that was honoring. David takes it and dumps it on the ground. And he pours it out to the Lord. And he says, keep rolling, Jimmy, in 17.
And he said, be it far from
All right, so he pours it out before the Lord, kind of like a drink offering, like in Numbers, and these guys apparently are honored by it. He's so amazed by their courage and faithfulness, loyalty to David, that he won't drink it. He's like, man, these guys risked their lives for this. I can't drink this. So verse 18, Abishai, the brother of Joab, you guys remember this guy, we've seen him a ton of times, the son of Zeruiah was chief of the 30, and he swung his spear against 300 and killed them. And he had a name as well as the three. So Abishai, one of the leaders, Joab, Abishai, and I forget who the other guy is. It's among the three. Abishai is one of the fiercest battlers amongst David's crew. Okay.
Go ahead. He describes that he killed 300 men with a spear. It would be normally like a sword, but he's sitting there like...
Yeah. He always has a spear, and he never has, he never has a sword in his hand, okay? 20, this guy's one of my favorites, okay? Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, the son of a valiant man of Kabzeel, who had done mighty deeds, killed the two sons of Ariel at Moab. So apparently these guys are bad, Moabites. And then it says he went down and killed a lion in the middle of a pit on a snowy day. Just this random, like, where do you find a pit in Israel? As you think about pits that we've seen, maybe Joseph, he got thrown into a pit. What was that?
Well, it's a water basin.
Yeah, it's a water basin. It's a cistern. It's this big dugout pit. So for whatever reason, Benaiah finds himself in a pit on a snowy day, one-on-one with a lion. That's a bad place to be. Okay, that's called a cage fight. You can't get out. It's a bad situation all the way around, right? If you've seen the movie 300, which... I don't advise, but if you've seen it, it's the training of the Spartans, right? One of the pictures that they have is this kid has to go out and kill a wolf, right? And you're like, you're alone, you're one-on-one, and you've got to kill this vicious animal. Like, someone's going to leave this situation dead. It's either you or the lion. And Benaiah steps up, and he kills a lion in a pit in a snowy day. A hard task and a hard place and a hard time. Like, man, but he gets it done. So you just see... these pictures of David's men, okay? 21, this is my favorite thing about Benaiah, okay? Read that.
He
Egyptian had a spear in his hand, but he went down to him with a club and snatched the spear from the Egyptian's hand and killed him with his own spear.
That's awesome. So he is defenseless. This bad Egyptian's threatening him with a spear. He grabs the guy's spear and then impales him with his own spear, right? It's awesome. Jane, it's not sad. Don't give me that face. It's so good.
There's so much gore here.
It's great. It's one of my favorite chapters in the Bible. What are you guys talking about? Have you seen the movie Tombstone?
Yeah.
There's a clip in there, you can YouTube it, where Wyatt Earp walks into a bar and this guy is... he's running his mouth, and he's kind of taking over this bar. And the reason he's there is there's a gambling game that's going on, and he's kind of controlled the bar so that he can get the proceeds. And this guy's running his mouth, and Wyatt Earp, who's the sheriff in town, walks in and hears about this guy who's been running his mouth. And Wyatt Earp's a retired sheriff, and he's not armed, right? And this guy starts running his mouth and looks at Wyatt Earp and makes fun of him and basically clowns him because he's not even carrying a firearm. And this guy has two on his hip. And he starts running his mouth. And Wyatt basically stands up to the guy. And you can see that he wants to fight him. And he thinks he has the upper hand with Wyatt Earp. And Wyatt's just basically daring him to take him on. And then in the scene, Wyatt grabs the guy's gun, pulls it out of his holster, and smacks him with the butt end of his gun, right? And he's just standing there bleeding. And one of the best lines of the whole movie, Wyatt Earp says to the guy who's just standing there, who's got two guns, and now he only has one because Wyatt just slapped him with one of them. He's like, are you going to do something, or are you just going to stand there and bleed? And the guy basically cries and walks out of the room. It's awesome. It's one of the best four-minute clips you'll ever see in a movie. That's Benaiah, right? This was Wyatt Earp was like the reincarnation, if there was such a thing, of Benaiah. This guy's bad. Grabs the Egyptian spear, impales him with his own spear. But you get the idea that these are David's men, right? The type of guys that he had around him. They were fiercely loyal. They would lay down their lives for David in a heartbeat. They would march through a Philistine army to get David water from a well in Bethlehem and then bring it back. And then David, to honor them, would pour it out. I mean, these are the guys that were with David his entire reign as king. And I mentioned before that Rick said about David, and I think it's so right, many great leaders, people will lay their lives down for the leader, but what you don't see is a leader who's willing to lay their lives down for them. And that is what makes, I think, David unique, and the reason why people are so fiercely loyal to David, at least the ones in his innermost circle. Okay, so crazy picture of David's guys. Okay, so Jane, we're done. Okay, 23 is over, so be encouraged. Okay, but that's it. Okay, so there's the dude's chapter of the day.
Action movies?
Yeah, wouldn't you love to see like these guys like just put on film somewhere? So it'd be great. We could have a guys' night and go watch it.
Yeah, but then we'll criticize it because they don't fully illustrate the.
Yeah. As long as, was it Ridley Scott? He's the guy that did The Exodus. As long as he doesn't get a hold of it.
They should have Vin Diesel play this guy that took the spear from
him. I can see that. All right, now 24, an odd chapter. Okay, this is weird. Okay, figure this one out. Hannah, pick up there in 24:1.
Again, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he moved David against them, saying, go. Number Israel and Judah.
Okay, so an odd deal. It says God's anger burns against Israel, burns against David specifically, and he incites David to go number Israel. Okay, in 1 Chronicles 21, we see the same story mentioned there, and it says that Satan incited David to go number the people. Okay, here it says the Lord. It looks like it was Satan, and maybe God allows it, similar to a Job-esque type story. Why would God be displeased in David's wanting to number the people? What is David doing?
Isn't he like taking ownership for the kingdom as his own and not God's?
Yeah, that's the idea. So God's frustrated that David wants to kind of put a tally mark on the board and say, look at my kingdom. Look how many people there are. Okay? And lo and behold, look who gives him advice in verse 2.
But the king said to Joab, the captain of the host was with him, go now through all the tribes of Israel, from Dan even to Beersheba, and count the people that I may know their number.
Joab, go number everybody, okay? And Joab says in verse 3,
may the Lord your God add 100 times as many people as there are, and let the eyes of my Lord the king see it. But why does my Lord the king delight in this thing?
So what's Joab say?
Why do you want
him? You can have a million people, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I hope God increases your flock 100-fold. That's I want that for you. However, why do you want to do this? What's Joab doing? He's picking at his motives. Why, David, what's going on here? I think this is a bad idea. And Joab is 110% right. David shouldn't have done this. So he's given David, again, good counsel. Nevertheless, verse 4, the king's word prevailed against Joab, against the commandments of the army. So Joab does exactly what he's told. He goes and numbers the people from north to south. At the end of verse 8, this took 9 months and 20 days. That's a big census, right? It takes almost an entire year to do it. And here's the number that we get in verse 9. This is what David wanted.
And Joab gave the sum of the numbering of the people to the king. There were in Israel 800,000 valiant men who drew the sword, and the men of Judah were 500,000.
Okay, so we've got 1.3 million valiant warriors. This is men 20 years old and up that can fight. Okay, so it's the same type of numbering system that we've seen in the past. So you take that, you add that probably to that many women. So now you got 2.6 million men and women over 20 in David's kingdom. You add some chitlins to that. Man, we've got easily 3-4 million people in David's kingdom. So David got what he wanted. And then verse 10, after he got what he wanted.
But David's heart smote him after he had numbered the people. David said to the Lord, I have sinned greatly in what I have done. I beseech you, O Lord, take away the iniquity of your servant, for I have done very foolishly.
So, man, he realizes in hindsight, Joab was right. I shouldn't have numbered the people. This was 110% pride on my part. I wanted to be able to count nickels and noses, as we say in church. Like, this was not right. So I should have left it alone. And he comes to God and says, Lord, forgive me. That was dumb. And God says, man, I love you. However, you're going to get to experience some consequences of that. But it's a choose-your-own-adventure book. I'm going to give you three consequences, and you get to choose which one you want. Okay, fascinating. So, God, through this guy by the name of Gad, the prophet, goes to David and says, I am offering you three things, in verse 12, choose for yourself one of them, which I may do to you. So there's going to be consequences to your action. Verse 13, keep reading, Hannah.
So God came to David and told him and said, shall 7 years of famine come to your land, or will you flee 3 months before your pursuing enemies? Or do you prefer 3 days of pestilence in your land? Consider and see what answer I shall return to him who sent me.
All right, so there are your three options. Shall 7 years of famine come? Does anybody have a different number than seven, by the way, in that? Should be three, okay? It's a typo. A typo. It's, again, one of the, these are the major errors in your Bible. Is it three or is it seven? It completely changes your theology and Jesus is no longer Lord. Okay, so these are the errors that people are talking about when they say there's errors all over the Bible. Just so we're clear, this is the type of stuff that we're dealing with. So 99.5% accurate, but there are texts that say seven. There's texts that say three. It's pretty clear that it's three. You want 3 years of famine? You want 3 months running, or do you want 3 days of pestilence? Three, three, three. Okay? Pretty easy to figure out, right? A high school sophomore, my daughter, can figure this out, right? But that's those are the major errors in your Bible, okay? So David's given three options. Do you want famine? Do you want to run from your enemies? Or do you want my wrath for 3 days? So you can have famine for 3 years, you can be running from your enemies for 3 months, or you can have me bring in the heat for 3 days. What do you want? And David says, let us now fall into the hand of the Lord, for his mercies are great, but do not let me fall into the hand of men. Meaning, I don't want to be running from my enemies. I've been there, done that. That's not fun. And I'd rather lean on God. I don't want famine. Is basically what he's saying that. He says, so let's let God give 3 days of pestilence. Let's see what happens. I'm going to trust the Lord. Okay? 15, here are the consequences. Read that. Emily, read that. You'll like this one.
And there died of the people from Dan to Beersheba
70,000 innocent people die because of David's sin. Does that seem right? That's hard, right? Welcome to leadership. Are there consequences the further you get up the tree? Absolutely. That's crappy. Those are dads. Those are brothers. Those are sons. Those are people's lives that did nothing but just live in Israel, got numbered, and God says, David, you shouldn't have done this, and I'm bringing justice, and instead of taking David's life or people in David's family, these are men from all over Israel that die.
When you first read the options, it seemed like a no-brainer that he would flee for 3 months before his enemies, because God didn't say that they were going to capture him and kill him, so all he has to do is run, and that keeps his people safe.
why would he choose the consequence for himself
yeah.
that goes on his people?
Yeah. I think the assumption is that's not the case. I think he's saying you're going to lose for 3 months in battle to the Philistines. And as a result of that, people are going to die. You're going to go to battle. Basically, you're going to run from them. But your whole country is going to be underneath siege from the Philistines. So people are going to die. So it wasn't, I don't think that clear. I think David actually chose the route that he thought God at least could choose to be gracious here. I'd rather be at the hand of the Lord than at the hand of the Philistines. They're merciless. God could choose to change his mind or at least give me mercy in the midst of it. In fact, God does. He literally stays his hand against the angel of the Lord and says, that's enough. We're going to stop at 70,000. It's rough, but that's it. Okay, we see in verse 16, the angel stretched out his own hand towards Jerusalem to destroy Jerusalem. And the Lord relented from the calamity and said to the angel who destroyed the people, it is enough. Relax your hand. So it's rough. Okay, so that's my take. I think David just threw himself at the mercy of the Lord, not knowing what was best. And, you know, you can argue whether what choice was right, but I think all of them would have ended in death for his people. And it's a hard punishment. And David's learning at the end of his reign. I mean, he is in the last years of his reign. A hard lesson, okay? Verse 16, the angel of the Lord, last part of it, was by the threshing floor of Araunah the Jebusite. Okay, so we're in Jerusalem. He was getting ready. The angel of the Lord was to destroy the land. And he ends up at this guy's threshing floor by the name of Araunah. Okay, 17, let's keep reading. Watch how God is going to take now this thing that looks like a catastrophe and actually bring about his will in the midst of it. 17.
Then David spoke to the Lord when he saw the angel who was striking down the people and said, behold, it is I who have sinned. It is I who have done wrong. To be sheep, what have they done? Please let your hand be against me and my father's house.
So does David get it? Absolutely. He realizes, I've caused this, and this punishment should have been against me. Why God did it that way, I don't know. But David understands, listen, God, if I could trade that 70,000 for me in my family, I would do it. Okay? So, verse 18.
So Gad came to David that day and said to him, go up, erect an altar to the Lord on the threshing floor of Araunah the Jebusite. David went up according to the word of Gad, just as the Lord had commanded.
All right, so Gad tells him, go make an altar on this guy's property and confess, basically. End this plague, okay? Araunah now looks down and saw the king coming in verse 20. And Araunah went out and bowed his face before the ground before the Lord. This has got to be an odd sight, like you're just out plowing your fields. You're in your threshing floor. And here comes the king of Israel at 70 and says, hey, bro, I'm gonna make an altar in your backyard. Is that cool? Like, oh yeah, hi David, like, man, nice to see you. You want to come to have, this was shocking. This guy says, why has my lord the king come to my servant? Like, David, why are you here? Like, good to see you, but this is odd. And watch what David says. To buy the threshing floor from you in order to build an altar to the Lord that the plague may be held back from the people. So part of this plague ending was David to be there to build the altar, but David felt like he needed to own the piece of land that this altar was going to be on. Okay? 22, keep reading.
Araunah said to David, let my lord the king take and offer up what is good in his sight. Look, the oxen for the burnt offering, the threshing sledges and the yokes of the oxen for the wood. Everything, O king, Araunah gives to the king. And Araunah said to the king, may the Lord your God accept.
So what does Araunah say to David? What does that mean? Take it all. Take it for free. And not just take the land. What else? Here's the oxen. Here's the wood for your burnt offering. Here's some lighter fluid, right? Here's some matches. Like, everything you need to build your altar, David, take it. You're the king. You can have it all. Now, watch what David does. This is a great, great theology of worship here. Okay? This is beautiful. Verse 24.
Said to Araunah, no, but I will buy it of you for a price.
Why would David want to buy it? Can't take it back, okay? Obviously, and you see even that with like Abraham buying the cave at Machpelah. Like, I want ownership. I want to be in this land. This is ours, right? I've got skin in the game. Keep rolling, Hannah.
I will not offer burnt offerings to the Lord my God of that which costs me nothing.
I will not offer burnt offerings to the Lord which cost me nothing. What is David saying? I'm going to sacrifice to make this happen. If I give, Aruna, all your stuff and sacrifice it to God, that costs me nothing. Your sheep, your altar, your wood, I'm not going to do that. So I'm going to purchase it. I'm going to make my worship hurt a little. It's going to cause me to sacrifice. I'm going to have to give. I'm going to have to dig here to make this happen. Now, David's, he's the king, right? He's got a bank account that's bigger than all of ours, right, combined. So he's not hurting for cash, but he is saying, I'm going to do something. So he says, David bought the threshing floor and the oxen for 50 shekels of silver. In 1 Chronicles 21, 25, we see the same story mentioned, and there's an additional 600 shekels that are paid for this site. So David buys both the site and then the oxen and the wood and everything else, and pays him, it looks like, 650 shekels of silver. Now, this wasn't an astronomical amount, right? But it was a sacrifice nonetheless, okay? So verse 25, David built there an altar to the Lord and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. In verse 25, thus the Lord was moved by prayer for the land, and the plague was held back from Israel. Now, that's the end of 2 Samuel. Why is that such an important story? Why would 2 Samuel end with the purchasing of Aruna's backyard and David building an altar to check the plague of God?
A repentance of the land?
Certainly. You see a great repentance. You see David leading his people in prayer, and right? And it's a great mark of David at the end of his life. Where are they? Where is Aruna's land?
Outside.
It says in the text. What city? What?
He's a Jebusite.
He is? Yes? Who's a Jebusite? What land do the Jebusites live in? What city? Jerusalem. Yay! You guys are brilliant! David just bought a plot of land in Jerusalem. Does anybody know where that plot of land is?
That temple that you showed us.
How about that? It's on Mount Moriah. David just bought the land where Abraham went to sacrifice his son Isaac. What is going to get built on this plot of land? By his son, the temple. Who owns that land?
Solomon now
and the Jewish people. David bought that land. That's their land. Okay, so fabulous piece where God connects the dots from Abraham all the way back to Isaac. He buys this whole mountain area, Mount Moriah, and this is the site where the temple will be built. Specifically, this is the area where the Ark of the Covenant will sit. At the top of this kind of mountain peak on the threshing floor. Again, the threshing floor was always the highest hill, so the wind would come up there, you could thresh your wheat, right? So this is the top of Mount Moriah. Okay, and Aruna, the Jebusite, owned it and gives it to David, and David says, no, I'm buying it from you, and here's the receipt. Okay, so the Jews, they purchased this plot of land. Okay, so David owns it, and then he hands the deed over to his boy Solomon, and then they're going to build the temple on that site. Yeah, he got ripped off. So 50 shekels of silver, by the way, I got to note, is 1.25 pounds of silver. So it's a decent amount, but then he adds 600 to that. So he gives him almost, what is that, like 800 pounds of silver? It's not a bad day. I'd take 100 pounds of silver. You know, that's, I guess. I think the theme of it is David buys the land. They own it. What's the biggest debate in the Middle East in this area right now?
Who owns the Temple Mount?
Who owns the land, right? The Jews think they own it, the Christians think they own it, and the Muslims think they own it. And everybody wants rights to this land. And this little area of square footage is the most hotly contested piece of real estate in the world and has caused more divisions and wars amongst people groups and religions and, right? It is a hot mess. Anyway, but according to the text, David owned it. David bought it. David has the deed of the land, right? If we could just find that receipt, that would be really nice.
We got the receipts, right?
Yeah, well, you show that to a Muslim and see if they think it's a valid receipt. So they obviously don't. And Christians obviously think that they have rights to that, which we don't. So, but
Mike, I remember something in the news just popped up that said something that either justified this or something else.
Hmm. I haven't seen it. Find it if you can. I'd love to see it. Yeah.
Something in the news just popped up that, I don't know, it was the last couple of years, where they discovered something, I think it was like a clay tablet or something, that effectively proves a couple things, which would be, I think, a receipt saying...
Yeah, that would be epic. See if you can find it. I know they discovered another Dead Sea cave, like that's the most recent, but yes. Yeah, see what you can find. And then snoops it, make sure it's not fake. So moving into 1 Kings, right? This is immediately on the heels of this. These books go together, if you will. 1 Kings chapter 1. By the way, 2 Samuel was all about the idea of establishing the kingdom. We had preparation in 1 Samuel, establishing in 2 Samuel. 1 Kings is going to be about division. Okay, we are going to see David's united monarchy crumble underneath Solomon. Okay, so by the time we get to chapter 11 and 12 of 1 Kings, we're going to see this kingdom crumble. Okay. Now, David the king was old, verse 1, advanced in years. They covered him with clothes, but he couldn't keep warm. Literally, he is on his deathbed. And they said to his servants in verse 2, let us find a young virgin for my lord the king. Let her attend to the king and become his nurse, and he may lie in her bosom and keep the king warm. So they literally find a, like a nursemaid, basically, for David. It's a concubine that there's no... hanky-panky going on, if you will, but she is there to take care of David and keep him warm. So they find a gal. She is a Shunammite, verse 3. Her name is Abishag, okay? Verse 3, remember her name, Abishag the Shunammite, okay? She's David's kind of concubine at the end of his life, to his nurse, to take care of him. We find out, verse 4, she's beautiful. She's the king's nurse, but the king, at the end of verse 4, did not cohabit with her, okay? So... the Hebrew word is hanky-panky, okay? Verse 5, Adonijah, the son of Haggith, exalted himself and said, I will be king. Who's Adonijah? He's one of the sons of David, okay? Who's supposed to be the next king? Solomon. We know that. It's been said. However, this guy steps up and says, I'm the new guy in town. So we've had now a second son of David rise, at least in a coup, and try to be king. And Adonijah is going to step up and say, I want to be king. Now, he prepared for himself chariots and horsemen, 50 men to run before him in verse 5. So he sets his own parade. He has a party that he's going to invite everybody to. He was a very handsome man, we see at the end of verse 6. He was born after Absalom, so I think he's the fourth born son. And look who he rallies with him. This is a major deal. Joe, read that in 7. So who comes with Adonijah? Joab. God, this guy, he just can't figure out how to not flip-flop every day. And Abiathar, the priest at the time, who's been with David forever. So this is a big move. When you take two big tokens from David's life, guys that have been loyal to David, you see what what Adonijah's doing. He's trying to demonstrate that he has the heart of the people, and they're coming with him. But, verse 8, Zadok, the priest, and these other guys, we see Nathan the prophet, and the David's mighty men, they don't go with him. They don't go with Adonijah. They stay with David. Verse 9, Adonijah throws a giant party in verse 9, invites all these people to it, but he doesn't invite Nathan the prophet, Benaiah, that guy that we read about, the Wyatt Earp, before Wyatt Earp's time. They all stay with David, okay? Word now gets to Nathan, Nathan the prophet, who we've read about before, that There's an issue. David needs to make a decree. Why, by the way, do we have this issue going on in regards to who's going to be the next king? Partly. Absolutely. There's too many wives. We've got too many sons. So what has David failed to do?
Name an heir.
He hasn't named an heir. He's on his deathbed. Literally. He can't keep warm without the assistance of a warm body next to him. He's dying. But he's failed to communicate to the people his wishes and what God has told him. So he's created this chaos. So Bathsheba, the mother of Solomon, says, "Hey, have you not heard, Nathan, that Adonijah has risen up to become king? He's thrown a party. You need to go talk to David and have him make a decree about who's going to be the next king. We have chaos in the kingdom. Go to the king in verse 13 and tell him this," right? 15, Bathsheba now goes into the king, into the bedroom. He's with Abishag, who's ministering to the king. Verse 16, Bathsheba bows before the king and says, verse 17, "My lord swore to your maidservant, the Lord your God, saying, 'Surely your son Solomon shall be king after me and sit on my throne.'" David, you've said that to me. You said that to others privately, but you haven't said it publicly. So we have a problem. As for you, verse 20, "My lord the king, the eyes of all of Israel are on you to tell them who shall sit on the throne of my lord the king afterward. Otherwise, when you die, I'm an outcast. Solomon's an outcast. It's going to be a disaster. David, step up and lead." Do you see the same issue that David has had his entire reign? Of passivity. He won't step up at critical times and draw a line in the sand and say, "Adonijah, I love you, proud of you, you're not going to be the king." Okay? And he's created confusion. Why David has done this, we're not sure, but he's been hesitant to make this call for whatever reason. But finally, he says, okay, 28, "Call Bathsheba back to me." He gets counsel from Nathan. And in verse 30, he says, "Your son Solomon shall be king after me. Those are my wishes, Bathsheba." So they do that. Verse 33, the king says, "Take you, the servants of your Lord, have my son Solomon ride on my mule. Bring him down to Gihon, where we're going to anoint him as king. Let Zadok the priest, Nathan the prophet, anoint him there as king over Israel and blow the trumpet and say, 'Long live Solomon.'" Make it public, make it loud, make it official. Solomon's my guy. So he ultimately does this. Verse 39, they bring Solomon out. Verse 39, you see Zadok, now the priest, take a horn of oil, anoint Solomon from the tent. So they have made now this public proclamation that Adonijah is not going to be the next king. Solomon is the next king, which was David's wishes all along. Okay. The problem is Adonijah is at his house party, patting himself on the back, commending himself to be the next king. They don't get this news, and they get a guy that comes to him and says, "Hey, bad news. David just anointed Solomon king, and you're in here partying," right? Thinking, this is all good, okay? So he gets word. They all freak out. Verse 50, or verse 49, all the guests of Adonijah were terrified. They all arose and each went on his way. That's a quick way to end a party, right? Oh, I guess I'm not going to be king, okay? And Adonijah realizes, whoops, I screwed up. Adonijah was afraid of Solomon. He arose and went and took hold of the horns of the altar. Okay, this is a phrase that we're going to see moving forward. What does that mean, that he took hold of the horns of the altar? Where is the altar? It's part of the tabernacle where the animals were slain out front. So he runs to Gibeah, where the tabernacle is, and falls on the altar. The idea being, Solomon, you can't kill me. I'm on base. Okay, Joab did that, or he's going to do that. That's kind of the concept. So I'm in the house of the Lord, literally where the tent of meeting was, the actual tabernacle. David has the ark, but all the other implements are there. He falls on the altar and says, "You can't kill me here." And Solomon basically says, "Man, listen, I'm not going to kill you." And basically, at the end of verse 53, Solomon says, "Go to your house. Don't be an idiot." See, where does it say? Verse 52. If he will be a worthy man, not one of his hairs will fall on the ground. But if wickedness is found in him, he will die. Adonijah, go home. I get it. You wanted to be king. You're not king. I don't need to prove my manhood here. I'm not going to kill you. Go home. Live your life in peace. Don't rise up against me, and we can live in peace. So you see Solomon, he's 20, 21, by the way, at this time. He's about to be anointed king. Is a wise young man. Okay, and you're going to see that characteristic about Solomon moving forward. So he tells Adonijah, we're brothers, half-brothers, go home. I don't want your life, okay? We'll pick up on verse 2 and following, chapter 2 and following next week, or the week after next, after spring break, I should say, and now kind of transition into Solomon's reign and see him pick up the throne. And you will see this young man right out of the gates, marked by incredible wisdom as he leads now the nation of Israel.
One week off.
Enjoy your week off. Sleep well. Hey, let's finish strong, okay? So we've got just 3 weeks left after spring break. So we got a lot yet to cover, so stay faithful.
I get to sleep in.